I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man. Okay. I've been everywhere,
man. I hope that's all right.
That's fine.
Yes. Yes. Welcome to Barnstorming. It's good to have you here. My name is Taylor Lightman, one of your good co-hosts. Used to do politics professionally. Now I have gone to school and I'm looking for work. Taylor Lightman, and always a pleasure to be here with Jordy.
Hi, Taylor.
Intrepid co-host.
Yes, this is Jordy Comas. Right. Today I'm wearing my chair of the Public Works and Police Subcommittee of Borough Council because I just came from one of those meetings where we covered everything from dog poops to bathroom fixtures to long lines coming out of Dunkin' Donuts. So, you know, get involved in local governance. And as you'll hear, our guest herself has also been involved in local governance. So we're thrilled to have Amanda Green Hawkins. Would you like to say hi?
Hello, hello. Thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Jordy, so much for having me. It's going to be fun, I'm sure. And I'm just excited to answer your questions and to let the people know about me and my candidacy for Commonwealth Court.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and we should say at the outset here, just for all of our listeners and to just reaffirm this, candidates that are running for judicial offices are not allowed to make promises about any type of issues or you're allowed to discuss things in general, but you're not allowed to make any promises about any particular type of court case that might come in front of you because in the course of your, when you are a judge, if you are elected, you want to be completely impartial and just look at the facts of each one. Is that correct?
Well, this is an appellate court and you want to be able to appear neutral and unbiased. And you want to be, not just appear, but you also want to be unbiased and fair when you're hearing cases. And so I don't take positions on issues or on proposed legislation or on cases or anything like that. I am allowed to say what my opinion is and to make sure I am clear that it is indeed my opinion. However, given the issues that may bring concerning any impartiality as well, that is generally not anything that I do.
So do you mentioned the Commonwealth Court. Do you want to, because I know for, you know, I'm sure you deal with this all the time, you know, for your average voting citizen, the appellate system in Pennsylvania, it can seem a bit like hard to understand or complicated. Do you want to, you know, tell us how you usually explain its role?
Yeah, that's not a problem at all. And for most people, it really is confusing what goes on in the appellate system as opposed to their local court of common pleas, which is what many people are familiar with. Their local court of common pleas, where they can go here, where they can go file a lawsuit if they've had a car accident, if there's a criminal matter, if there's a matter with a trust in estates issue in the family, someone's deceased. Also, family court, if there's divorce and child custody issues, people are familiar with that. Those appeals get taken to the Superior Court. Common Pleas Court decisions get appealed to the Superior Court. The Commonwealth Court is also an intermediate appellate court on the same level, if we're talking about hierarchies, it's on the same level with the Superior Court, except that it's hearing appeals from state administrative agencies. This is the court that also hears matters concerning the government. So lawsuits by the government or against the government are going to be brought in Commonwealth Court. And it's also where election law matters are heard as well. So just think of all things related to the government are generally going to be heard in the Commonwealth Court.
Right. And I was looking at this yesterday on the official Commonwealth Court webpage. They have a section that says for all of the appellate courts, so Commonwealth and Superior, which are co-equal, it's kind of a division of labor. Superior is things that are right, like citizens, and Commonwealth is government as one of the parties, if I said that right.
Can I interject for one quick second though? Because the Commonwealth Court can be considered like the people's court, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can go and take on the government mm-hmm. because the government has taken something away from you and needs to give it back, or they haven't given you something and you want it and they need to give it to you.
Right.
You think of it like that, like a license or something like that. It's where you can go and take on the government about your taxes or anything else.
Right. So that's a great point. Or I guess, would it be fair to say also things that are, you know, our rights as citizens, if the government has done something to, you know, interfere or block those rights, would that also go to Commonwealth Court?
I'm sorry, your voice is breaking.
Sorry. I'm saying if it had to do with your rights. So, for example, as a citizen, you know, we talk about a right to vote. If you think, I'm guessing if there were a case about what the police could or couldn't do in terms of civil rights, because it's a government entity, police interfering with rights, that would probably go to Commonwealth Court.
Well, it depends.
Okay. All right.
And I hate to be the lawyer here.
No, right? That's all right.
It depends. Are you, is the lawsuit against a government or local government agency or against a government body, right? Then that's going to be Commonwealth Court. If it is a matter concerning a violation of civil rights, that could be something in state court or maybe even federal court,
right?
As well. And generally, even though some issues could be handled in the Commonwealth Court, many people go to federal court. And I'm just saying this because of my experience doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
Federal.
This is kind of jumping the gun a little bit because I feel like the arc of what we envisioned the interview being was first going over your background and then talking about like judicial philosophy and then doing this fun game we have planned so that listeners can understand your how you'll be as a judge. But I am curious, since it is the Commonwealth Court and Pennsylvania is a Commonwealth, like in what sense do you think that like our being a Commonwealth affects the decision making in the Commonwealth Court? Like that it is a like quote unquote Commonwealth. Like does that bear anything? Like would a ruling be decided differently if we were a state, you know?
I don't think so. when we think of just even the word Commonwealth and what it means, you think of literally like for the good of the people, government by the people. And that's at the core of all the states, right? And so I just think it's just a throwback, if you will, to when we were colonies, right? For the good of the British monarchy, right? Or the British Empire. And now we only have, what, four Commonwealths? And I've lived in two of them, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, the two I've lived in. And then there's Kentucky and Virginia. Yeah, and the judges have to follow the law. So here in Pennsylvania, whatever the law is, judges have to follow the law and make sure that it is rooted in the Constitution, which is the foundation for anything and everything that the government is going to do. So the fact that it's a Commonwealth shouldn't bear on the decision-making of the judges who have to serve with fairness and impartiality and following the law. Now, it may matter more for legislators, perhaps, because of the Constitution, but not so much for judges.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I'll just take this opportunity to point out that in Pennsylvania, we have a, not to you, but to our listeners. I say this at every opportunity. We have a constitutional right to clean air and water in Pennsylvania, which I think is so cool.
But I do think, you know, one reason, you know, we were thinking about that is because that language of Commonwealth now outside of judicial spheres, I think can be really useful to think about, a kind of solidarity framework for other parts of the law, right? Like, you know, we should have a tax code that make sure that everybody can participate in the common prosperity as opposed to just being a thing that's like, how many loopholes are there that, you know, this wealthy person or this wealthy company can drive through. But yeah, let's maybe, we have done this maybe a little bit topsy-turvy, but you know, I think people really want to know, who was Amanda, your biography, like, what's the story you like to tell voters?
Oh my goodness. So, well, I think it's important for people to know that, yes, I am Amanda Green Hawkins, running for the Commonwealth Court here in Pennsylvania. I live right in the city of Pittsburgh with my husband and our two children, and they're both Pittsburgh Public School students. So people should know that I am a COVID mom, I should say, at home with two kids studying virtually here at home and working from home. And know what it's like to be a work part of a working family in this during this pandemic or crisis. And I have been a lawyer with the Steelworkers Union for going on 20 years. And that makes me uniquely prepared as well as uniquely qualified for the Commonwealth Court, because as we've been discussing, it's the court that's handling all these government related matters, hearing appeals from the whole alphabet soup of our government agencies. And my career as a union lawyer is steeped in administrative law, which is what the court is doing. It's handling appeals from those administrative agencies. And so a strong background in administrative law is important for success on this court. And so I have appeared before administrative agencies because of the work that I do. I've done this work around the country at the federal level and at the state level, doing hearings before administrative agencies and appealing decisions of administrative agencies to federal courts and state courts around the country. In fact, I'm one of only 2,000 or so attorneys in the entire country recognized by the National AFL-CIO as a union lawyer. And I've been working for the largest industrial union in North America for the past 20 years. We represent about 1 million workers and retirees throughout the public and private sectors of our economy. So my background in the work of the court is extensive because of the work that I've done.
So I think I know what administrative law is.
A lot of people, when they become...
Can I just do this real quick, Taylor? I think a lot of people know what... I know what administrative law is, I think. But do you want to just sort of unpack that a little bit for people who... What is not administrative law?
Okay, so... people may be familiar with an agency like the Social Security Administration. Agencies are created to help the government administer and enforce statutes. Mm-hmm. And so the Environmental Protection Agency is charged with administering and enforcing environmental protection laws. And so same concept. So here in Pennsylvania, some of the agencies we have are the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board. They're charged with administering and enforcing the collective bargaining law here in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, the laws concerning discrimination in the workplace and public accommodation and in housing. That's what that agency deals with. Then there's the Department of Labor and Industry, which is looking at the health and safety matters, for example. Then the environmental protection, all of these things, gaming commission, right? They're charged with administering and enforcing a discrete area of the law. And they make rules and regulations regarding the interpretation of the law. And there's a whole system for drafting and crafting those regulations. And then there are administrative law judges in that system that look at the regulations and apply it to a set of facts to determine, for example, if you're going to get a license or not get a license to cut hair, to be a barber, or to operate a family child daycare home. You go to the agency to get the license. However, if it's taken from you for some reason, you can appeal it to the agency. And the agency says yes or no. And if it says no, you can appeal that denial to the Commonwealth Court. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah.
It does make sense. So I see like two questions, two branches that we could, I have two pressing questions and you can take whichever one you want. A lot of people go to law, first of all, like, why did you decide to become a lawyer is question number one. And question number two is like a lot of people go to law school and decide to join a private practice or do corporate law and make a ton of money. you chose to be a union lawyer. Why is that?
Which of your law school classmates are you going to throw under the bus?
Yeah.
I love law school to start with.
Northeastern.
Yeah, with a great interest, with a great reputation in producing lawyers who do public interest work. And I decided to was a question about going to law school or becoming a lawyer? Why did I become a lawyer was the question.
Yeah, but I guess why you went to law school is also an interesting question that you can just, your discretion.
I had to go to law school to become a lawyer. That's what my dad told me when I was seven, when I told him I wanted to be a Supreme Court justice.
Oh.
I wanted to be when I was like, first I wanted to be a nurse. And then I remember hearing about this Thurgood Marshall. There was a lot of talk about Thurgood Marshall. He was the Supreme Court justice. And I had no idea what that meant. I knew it was a big deal, though. And I knew because when I was little, he had been on the Supreme Court. And it was a big deal that he was on the Supreme Court. There was a lot of discussion about his background and the work that he did. And I was just awestruck about, this everything that was discussed about what he did, helping people. That's really what I understood. He was a lawyer who really did some wonderful things in our country to help people. And he was then a Supreme Court justice. So I wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. And my dad said, well, you'll have to go become a lawyer first, and you'll have to go to law school. And I said, okay. I had no idea of what that meant. Mind you, my dad only had an eighth grade education. He's telling me this is what I have to do. And here we are in the inner city of New Jersey. Like, okay, yeah, I'll just go to law school, become a Supreme Court justice. Not really understanding, at least for myself, the hurdles that would be in front of me to get to law school, to become a lawyer. But my dad was just like, this is all you have to do. Okay, great. And so that stayed with me. That really stayed with me, wanting to do something to help people. And then in law school, Northeastern, I met this professor who was the first attorney I'd ever met, who really loved to go to work every day. He was an adjunct. He did union side labor law. I was like, my goodness, what in the world does this guy do that he's excited to go to work every day? And he was a union side lawyer at a firm, one of his own firms in Boston. And so Northeastern's a co-op law school where you can go work, as long as you're under the supervision of an attorney, you can work anywhere in the world. And so I found opportunities with a union and a union side firm, and really enjoyed and loved the work. There were things I didn't quite understand about, taking sides when it comes to labor and employment law, union side or management side. That still wasn't quite clear to me yet, but I really enjoyed the work and working for a union. And so when I was interviewing for jobs after law school, I was actually looking at large firms because I was coming out with about $100,000 in student loans. I still have student loans like many people. And I needed to make a lot of money. So I was interviewing with a large firm out of the New York area and told them I wanted to do labor and employment law, and was asked quite bluntly by the attorney interviewing me, how would I feel about busting up a union? And it became instantly clear to me the work that would be required should I be in a large management firm. I clearly understood at that point what the management firm was doing. And he made sure I was clear about what they did. And I was like, I can't do it. I knew instantly I couldn't do it. My dad was a truck driver in a union. My mom worked in a leather factory. She was in a union. And I remember when my dad was about at risk of losing his job as a truck driver because he was an alcoholic. And his union stepped in for him. And he was able to go to rehab and to return to work. without incident for another 20 years. He retired with his dignity and his pension. And if that had not happened, my family's life would have been so different. I doubt if I'd even be sitting here able to talk to you as a lawyer, you know, running for Commonwealth Court or anything. The whole direction of our family would have changed because of the loss of those wages and benefits. It really would have. So that's why I became a union lawyer.
That's an amazing story. So if we could just rewind the clock a little bit. So you grew up in New Jersey and you went to Duke. You know, your mom was from North Carolina, or how did you end up? I'm from Tennessee originally.
Okay. That's well, my mom is originally from North Carolina. My dad's originally from South Carolina, but that didn't influence my my choice of undergraduate institutions. It was Duke was the best school I could get into, right? They were perceived as the best school that I could get into.
Well, it's a pretty damn good school, so.
Yeah, that was the theory, right? You go to the best school you can get into. And so, okay, there's a school called the Harvard of the South, right? And we joke that Harvard is the Duke of the North. Mm-hmm. And so, hey, let's go for it. Let's go for it. Why not? And it was a great experience there at Duke to learn, not just in the classroom, but also outside of the classroom. A lot of the learning takes place outside of the classrooms, you know, talking with other students from different backgrounds and just learning the things you learn from each other. And that being an international school that attracts international students and talent, it was just phenomenal. People always ask me about the basketball, though. And I'm like, I only went to one game. 4 years, I went to one game. I was too busy having fun with the other students.
Yeah. Sorry, just maybe one more question, if you feel comfortable talking about this. I might be wrong, but, you know, you talked about growing up with these two hardworking parents. You know, I think you said in a more kind of inner city environment in New Jersey. Like, was going to Duke or was somewhere earlier in your life a place where you know, you learn to be like, you know, a sort of positive, self-assured Black woman, like in these very kind of white spaces. Like, I feel like that's, you know, the kind of story, you know, I hear a lot from people who have that kind of lived experience.
Yeah. And I would attribute that to my mom. I say I have two personalities, right? Most people get to see my mother's daughter. Mm-hmm. She's nice and polite and all of that. Most you see her on a campaign trail and all that. And then there's my father's daughter, who is a totally different person. But my mom wanted to make sure that I could be in certain spaces and knew how to conduct myself in certain spaces. And so I remember she sent me to charm school. She even sent me to charm school when I was about 12, 13 years old. And it was $1,000. Wow. At the time, like 10 weeks or something like that. So you can imagine the sacrifice that this was for my mom, because they let her pay like $50 every time I went. I remember that. She would send me with the $50 and I would go. It was 20, that's right, it was 20 sessions. And, you know, where the forks are and the glasses and, the, you know, the dessert spoon and all this other craziness. But she, you know, but in her mind, you know, coming from the Jim Crow South, the segregated South, there were things that she knew were important to know how to do and to know in order to operate in these spaces. And even though she may not have had access to that, and even though she couldn't give me access to it, she could at least give me some tools to be able to operate in that. And so there I was in charm school, learning how to put on makeup and sing, all this other stuff. She did her best. She did her best, because I'm not always a little charm school girl. Many times I'm my dad's daughter, which is more comfortable. But and I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. I was one of four Black students, and this school was right in Jersey City, New Jersey, one of four Black students in my graduating class. And I went to, even before high school, I went to this accelerated enrichment program for seventh and eighth grade. And I was the only Black student in my class. So there were educational opportunities even before Duke that kind of plucked me from my environment to be exposed to different people and different cultures.
Right. So Duke was actually the most diverse school you went to of those three, probably, in terms of yes. proportions.
Yeah, you're right. You're right about that. Now, law school is a totally different story. I call us the world inside out. Mm-hmm. Mostly high percentage of minorities, high percentage of women, proportionately a large population of members of the LGBTQ plus community. I called us society inside out. It was mm-hmm. awesome, mm-hmm. awesome to hear voices like mine, to hear mm-hmm. perspectives like mine. So I didn't always have to be, you know, the student who spoke up about this. So I go, oh my goodness, can you take this? Okay, you're gonna address this. Okay, I'll take the
right.
next one.
Right. So before Taylor, I know Taylor wants to pivot to like a judicial philosophy, but I just kind of want to make a bridge a little bit because as I understand it, you know, you served on the Allegheny County Council for several years, and you've also been appointed to the Pittsburgh City's, it's like a police reform commission, and maybe there's some other public service, and of course there's all your union work. So, you know, does that kind of build a bridge to like running for like what, how do those things inform your thoughts about running for Commonwealth Court? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that's good to point out too, my work with my two terms on county council certainly influenced the work of the Commonwealth Court because it's a governing body. And we actually had been sued in Commonwealth Court. And I served on the Community Task Force on Police Reform. We had a lot of discussion about police reform and Act 111. And I also served on the Port Authority Board of Allegheny County, which is an entity that, you know, should get sued, is going to be in Commonwealth Court. So all of this work.
Port Authority for the river traffic, I guess?
No, the public transportation.
I see. Okay. Sorry. I just think very like ports with ships. Okay. Sorry.
No, not like that. Buses and our light rail system, public transportation.
Right.
Yeah. And this all influences my background, certainly informs my background and makes me even more, I think, uniquely prepared for the work of the Commonwealth Court, in addition to the administrative law work. Mm-hmm. Understanding the role of government and how it works and functions and its responsibilities.
I want to go back to the Pittsburgh Police Reform Task Force that you were on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in a real moment of reckoning and have been for several years now about restoring the trust between specifically like the police and the public. That trust has been broken. Full stop. And certainly the judicial system, while there are different branches of government, the judicial system is in there somewhere. How do you think that, like you could, but just broadly, how do you think we can restore that trust between the judicial system and the public?
Well, and I have to point to our interbranch commission because, people may ask, well, why is there broken trust? There's no broken trust. But when we look at our interbranch commission here in Pennsylvania, it reports that people are experiencing bias in our judicial system based on their race and age and gender and economic status, LGBTQ plus status. Think about it. This means that decisions are being made or assumptions are being made about people, which could then lead to them getting the process that someone believes that they are due instead of the due process guaranteed by our Constitution. And that is harmful to our system of justice because people have to have faith in it and confidence that they are being fully heard and treated with dignity and respect. And what can be done? Something that really has to be done is a commitment. There has to be a commitment to constantly assess your own biases, to address your own biases, and to act in a way that's contrary to how your biases would automatically lead you to act. And it's not about calling anyone racist or sexist or anything like that. It is becoming aware of your own automatic knee-jerk reactions because of the biases that you may have about certain groups of people, which influence decision-making. And until we can make that commitment to constantly combat that, it could be in our, it's going to be a part of the decision-making. And I think that, you know, that, like I keep saying, the constant about assessment of it will help restore the trust in the system, because people will see, one, the judicial system making an effort to rid itself of that bias, and they would feel more comfortable appearing in the judicial system that is working hard to rid itself of bias. I mean, we had a situation here in Allegheny County last year where a Common Pleas judge was accused of making racially inflammatory remarks about a juror. And these allegations came from the defense side as well as the district attorney side. So, you know, it really raised eyebrows, and people were watching, wanting to know, you know, is this true? What's happening? And many people were just, and, you know, even the question itself, right? Is this true? Oh my goodness, is this happening? Is harmful enough? But there were already, you know, people like, yeah, that's right. I believe that. I've seen that. That's harmful.
Can I follow up for a second, Taylor?
Yeah, of course.
So one thing, Amanda, I really appreciate hearing you say that, because like in the stuff that I do as a local official and also in terms of organizing, that, you know, like talking about racism and different kinds. And I do feel like sort of broadly, we don't talk enough about implicit bias and how much that's there. And, you know, for myself, you know, I think a lot of white people who have come to a better understanding, we probably need to talk more about that, right? Like, I can remember in my teens or 20s, that feeling of being a little uncomfortable in an elevator with a Black person. And so, like, because I think a lot of white people just get so defensive and fragile about it. And so for me, you know, I took some implicit bias tests or whatever, and just to realize that, like, you can make conscious choices, but we are all influenced by those things all the time. And not just about race, but about gender and all kinds of other things. And so, like, it's almost empowering, right, to be able to know that, because then it's like, these are things that influence my language or my behavior or my thinking that aren't necessarily things I chose. Or, like, here's another silly example. You know, I'm very much like a feminist. Like, I think men and women are equal. I have a daughter, you know, age 2, she's dancing around in Princess stuff. And I'm like, where did this come from? Right. Like, I actively tried to keep Princess things out of my household. How did she get infected with it? Right. So I appreciate you saying that. And you don't really need to respond to this, but I also think it's just this interesting tension, because, and this is me as a layperson, but, you know, the law aspires to a kind of universalism that all people are the same. It's also malleable to adapt to new knowledge that comes along, right? So statistics are used in ways that they never were, I don't know, 200 or 300 years ago. So there is this kind of like tension, right? Like, you know, the law can understand that everybody has implicit bias, but it also aspires to a kind of, you know, it has to impartiality. So there's just kind of an interesting tension there.
Yeah. Riffing off of this, and I think we should move on to a different question, but like the current conception of Lady Justice as blindfolded, like I wonder if that is, if we should have a new metaphor, like Justice as eyes wide open or something like that.
I have been saying this, and there was a time when the image of Lady Justice was without a blindfold.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. It wasn't here. I want to say somewhere in Europe. People probably Google it and find it. But I say that all the time, you know, because the isms that have existed in our country, racism, sexism, are at the foundation upon which a lot of our institutions were built. And to effectively disenfranchise people All you have to do is make sure it's
put on the blindfold.
Education, in employment, in the judicial system, in housing, in voting, in healthcare, in environment, in the environment, right? And you could see how someone who's disenfranchised in all those areas is like really set back in life. And so I say, you know, Lady Justice has to be, you know, justice has to be swift, it has to be impartial, and it has to be fair, and they have to blindfold so that you don't see. But I'm like, you know, sometimes we need to snatch that blindfold off of Lady Justice so she can see the effect on the people. Look at the people. Look at what you have been told to do. And look at the disparities on the people. That's where Lady Justice has to have compassion. You don't always have to swing the sword, right? Sometimes put it down so your hands are free to help lift somebody up, to help pull somebody up.
I think that's a campaign ad for you right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taking the blindfold off Lady Justice.
Yeah, we'll release that just separately. I think that we should move on to the rapid fire questions.
All right.
Oh, we're having fun.
we're about to have some more fun. So people, you know, they're going to see your name on the ballot next to a couple other people, and I guess they can vote for however many.
You can vote for however many you want. I ask for your vote. I ask for your vote. You can vote for no more than two. And okay. I am asking for the vote, for everybody's vote.
And you want to be a judge. And so we want to test your judicial
acumen.
We want to ask you a series of questions, and you can give a quick yes or no, or a quick response, or you can take some time to deliberate and give your reasoning. So we're just going to go rapid fire here so people can get a sense of what they're getting when they vote Amanda Green Hawkins.
Alrighty.
All right. So we were thinking about some questions here. And the first question is actually a question about a question. Oftentimes in these types of interviews, especially in Pennsylvania, people ask the Sheets or Wawa question. You know, do you like Sheets? Do you like Wawa? We want to know, is that a bad question?
I think it is, because I've been to Wawa and I've been to Sheets. So I can make an informed opinion. However, why would we want to put two contributing businesses against each other? We can have both.
Yeah.
And we enjoy both.
Pennsylvania has a big enough heart and stomach for both Sheets and Wawa. I agree.
Exactly.
All right. We're off to a good start. Question number two. How many different hot sauces should a diner have on hand at any given time?
Oh my goodness. I would say three.
Okay.
Three. So for a milder heat, a medium kind of kick it up heat, and then the kind that makes your nose run.
Do you have a suggestion? You know, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but what's your...
Oh, I don't have any brand name suggestions because I don't like spicy, like hot, spicy food. But okay. I could say like habanero, you know, scotch bonnet for the extreme, right? And maybe a milder would be like the red chili kind of pepper. And in the middle, they could find something, I'm sure.
Okay, so three. All right, third question. Is Pittsburgh a Midwestern city?
No. Look at the map. Look at the map. We're like 400 miles, right, from the ocean. That's not far at all. And, you know, I've been to the Midwest. It's hundreds of miles away from here. Look at the map.
Okay. Is Punxsutawney Phil overrated?
I would say he is a Pennsylvania icon, and he is trusted and adored. You can't overrate a groundhog, as cute as that.
I just think there's some other rodents and marsupials that deserve some attention. You know, maybe that's the social justice warrior in me. Real quick, so of sort of classic movies that deal with the law, which do you think is better, 12 Angry Men or To Kill a Mockingbird?
See, these are the kind of tough questions you're going to get on the Commonwealth Court.
And I would say, well, let's have a viewing party for both.
Oh, good answer. Let's get some evidence.
Take a vote. Oh, like they are both. Wow. I mean, they just capture so much about our society and the influence, you know, our isms have on justice, the outcomes of justice in our system. Oh, man, that one's hard. That one is really hard.
Well, that's fair. You know, you can schedule a hearing after there's been some discovery.
Yeah, have a hearing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to do the next one, Taylor?
Sure. Yeah. So, sort of riffing off off this last question, what do you think is the most preposterous legal movie? My Cousin Vinny or Miracle on 34th Street?
And do you remember, I had to look this up, Miracle on 34th Street, I watched it in black and white when I was a kid. It's the one where Santa Claus is on, you know, there's a trial about whether Santa Claus exists. It's an old black and white movie.
Miracle on 34th Street.
All right.
Okay. Do you think that social media like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter is a waste of time, or do you think it's a useful human tool?
Oh, social media is a great tool to spread the word about factual things. It is a very useful tool to get messages out and information out quickly to millions of people.
All right.
It's great.
I'm going to do the last one, don't mind, Taylor, because this is close to my heart. Given that we're a Commonwealth, shouldn't our Department of State be called the Department of the Commonwealth?
You know what? I thought about that. I have actually thought about that, Jordy. You know, this will make sense. Department of the Commonwealth.
I think it should be.
I'm sure the other Commonwealths do the same thing.
Well, I don't know. You could check it out. All right. Well, that's our quick fire. You know, I was already convinced. We'll put in a donation link. You know, I encourage people to support you by voting and giving, you know, giving donations. We met a couple of years ago when you ran for Superior Court. And I think one thing that's really important is you're the only person running coming right from real world experience, I believe, right? Everyone else is currently a presiding judge. And I think that that's so important for the things that you touched on. You know, these appellate courts, there's no requirement that they be that you go from judgeship to judgeship. And as great as a lot of judges are, it's its own world. You know, I think if you've been there for 5, 10, 20 years, you can be a little distant from the lived experiences that people have. So I really hope that you win and can serve everybody in Pennsylvania, you know, no matter your zip code or the color of your skin or whatever, because you'd be such a great great addition to that body.
Thank you, Jordy. I appreciate that. And can I add very quickly that on the Commonwealth Court, there are 9 judges. 6 of the 9 came to the bench right from law offices. They were attorneys elected to be a judge at the Commonwealth Court.
Interesting.
Extensive backgrounds in administrative law.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Amanda, if people want to find out more information about you or your campaign or keep in the loop and want to hear stuff, how would they find you online or stuff like that?
www.amandagreenhawkins.com. No E on the end of green. And Facebook, vote Amanda Green Hawkins. Again, no E on the green.
Yeah.
Great. And they can find your name on the ballot on May 18th.
May 18th. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. All right. Any other last thoughts? Amanda.
I humbly ask for your vote and for your support to get to Commonwealth Court. Thank Absolutely. You so much.
Thank you so much for coming on. This is a great conversation. And yeah. I also second everything Jordy said. I'll be sure to vote for you on May 18th. Or I'll be voting by mail, actually. So, it'll be awesome. Before May 18th.
Awesome. So,